Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation, on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I call your name, the echo is haunting, the echo is always the same. I call your name, the echo is haunting, an echo can never be changed, so I call your name, your name.
Welcome to Signs of Life Radio. I'm your host, Bob Ginsberg. We have a great guest tonight, Penny Smith. I just had one announcement for those who have a desire to go to one of our grief retreats, the Florida grief retreat in January in Fort Myers presently has 10 open spots. So if you would like to go, go onto the website and all the information is there as well as registration. If you had a question as the show goes on for Penny, the number here to call in is 888-627-6008. Penny Smith is a nationally certified hospice and palliative care nurse with 20 years of experience. Penny has worked in a variety of care settings and roles within hospice, including inpatient, home case management, education, quality, and regulatory. She currently works as a hospice quality assurance nurse for an organization in Washington State. Penny's a passionate advocate for hospice education with a mission to normalize the end-of-life process to remove the stigma and fear around hospice care, death, and dying. During the pandemic, she found her way to social media and discovered a unique way to utilize her death care expertise to provide education to a worldwide audience at a grassroots level. Using a variety of teaching styles, including TikTok trends, dark humor, dancing, and storytelling, Penny has gathered over 2 million followers across her social media platforms as @HospiceNursePenny. She's also the author of a new book called Influencing Death, Reframing Dying for Better Living. Penny, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah, I really admire your work, so I'm glad we have this opportunity to talk. You know, before we get started, you know, sometimes we assume people know things when they really don't. And I often make the assumption that everybody knows what hospice is, but I often find that a lot of people have no idea. So could you just give us a brief overview of what hospice is?
Sure. So hospice is end-of-life care. It is for people who have a terminal illness and a life expectancy of 6 months or less, although sometimes people live longer and they don't get kicked off of hospice as long as they still have that life expectancy. But it's really focused on symptom management and comfort for the person. Usually we try to help people stay in their own home or wherever they call home. We also care for the family as well in that we are providing them with education on how to care for their dying person and normalizing what they're seeing as death is unfolding for their person.
Well, that's a good overview. You know, I know from personal experience with my loved ones in hospice is that it was kind of a shock because, you know, you're used to taking them to see medical doctor after medical doctor and everybody's looking to find a way to make you better. And then you're suddenly thrust into a hospice environment where the goal is to make you comfortable, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's a big change for a lot of people, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's even a big change for medical providers, which is why we sometimes get late referrals because, you know, traditional medicine, they're trying to fix everything, cure everything. And sometimes, you know, there's some discomfort around having these conversations about end of life. Also, you know, it's kind of in a way they're throwing up their hands and saying, you know, we can't do anything more for you. You know, we in hospice believe there's lots more that we can do for people. But there's just this kind of disconnect because medical providers are taught in medical school how to keep people alive and how to save their lives. So sometimes we end up getting people kind of referred late to hospice by the time they're finally saying, all right, you know, this is the end of life. But that is, you know, one of the nice things about hospice is a person doesn't have to keep going to medical appointments. They don't have to keep going for treatment. They don't have to keep wondering if they're going to get better. You know that they're not. And in a way that does actually bring relief to the dying person to be able to finally go, okay, now I know I'm not going to get better. What do I want to do with the rest of my life? Certainly not sit in the waiting room at a hospital clinic or, you know, be hospitalized.
Yeah, I certainly understand that. I know it, when my wife went into hospice, it's just what you said. I mean, she found some comfort in that. You know, I mean, no more, you know, chemo, no more testing, no more, you know, it just, it's almost as if a relief that a weight has been taken off your shoulders. I'm sure that you get asked this a lot, but do people come up to you and say, I don't know how you do it. How can you work with the dying every day? It must be terribly depressing. How do you answer such a question?
Yeah, people say that all the time. It must be so sad. It must be so depressing. How do you do it? You know, you do have to have a certain mindset when you go into hospice care to be a nurse or social worker or a chaplain, whatever role you're doing in hospice. You understand that the person is dying. That's the expected outcome. So it's important to have good emotional boundaries, to remember that you are caring for this person and their family. This is not your person. It's this family's person. You're there to do a job. And so you have to have really strong boundaries. And also, it's actually not sad. I mean, you're with this patient and with the family, and you're connecting with them at this most, critical time in their life, that it's an event that's going to happen to all of us for one thing, but you know, you're connecting with them, and it's sacred, really. It's sacred to be with them as they're going through this journey and to be able to help them. You know, I always say death is the expected outcome, and my job is to make sure that the person is comfortable, their symptoms are managed, and their family is prepared for what is happening, and they're not scared as they're watching this happen to their person. And if I have met all of those goals, it's a job well done when they die. I've done a good job. So it's not sad. And you know, it's interesting too, because many, many of my patients and families have used humor for coping. And so, you know, you're with people and they're going through this hard time, but then they also find moments to laugh and joke, and you know, dare I say, it's kind of a fun job to be with people like this. There's an element of sadness, but it's rewarding. It's rewarding. It's a gift to me to be able to do that for people.
Yeah, well, I certainly understand that. And I was going to, you took the words out of my mouth, but many people describe it as a sacred experience. And I also agree with, you know, once we lose the ability to laugh at ourselves, you know, it's not good.
I mean, right.
I have a similar situation, you know, when we're at these, you know, we've been doing these grief retreats for 15 years, and we're with people over the weekend that are in such horrible pain at losing a loved one. And yet I always try to interject humor, you know, in my talks, because people actually, you know, they appreciate it. You know, I mean, you have to break the sadness once in a while, you know,
and
laugh at ourselves. Well, let's talk. I mentioned that you have a new book coming out. Is it available yet, or it's?
It's available for pre-order. It'll be shipped on January 14th. So it's available for pre-order, you know, like on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, anywhere where books are sold online. It's available to order.
Right, and as I mentioned, I mean, it's an intriguing title, "Influencing Death." Had you come up with that title? You know, in what way are we influencing?
So I came up with the title because I am a death influencer on social media. And so I just kind of thought it was catchy and, you know, influencing people to look at death and dying in a different way, to reframe it, really, so that, you know, you can enjoy life better. And the book is a memoir. So I, as a younger person, had a lot of difficulties in my life. I was a drug addict. I went to jail several times. I gave my son to his dad to raise when he was 4 years old. And finally turned my life around. And at the age of 40, went to nursing school. So I became a nurse when I was 42 years old. And so I, or 41 years old. So I've been a nurse for 21 years. I've been a hospice nurse for 20 years. So it was kind of a path of redemption for me. I felt like I needed to do service work to make up for my past, which is why I became a hospice nurse. So this book juxtaposes, you know, like my troubles in life with my journey becoming a hospice nurse. And then, of course, stories about how I've cared for people at the end of their life, and why I'm able to do that really is because of what I went through during my earlier life.
Well, that sounds really interesting. I can't wait to read it. Cause I assume you're also talking about some case studies of that.
Of people
you've cared for, end of life experiences and so forth. So,
absolutely. Oh yeah. Yeah. Lots of stories. Lots of stories. There's education. I can kind of consider it an educational memoir because there's a lot of education in there about the dying process, how we care for people that are dying. But really, you know, how we think about death and dying can really influence how we live. You know, if you talk to any hospice professional, they'll tell you that it changes your life to work with people who are facing death because you realize how short it is. You know, I've cared at every age I've ever been as a hospice nurse. I've cared for people much younger than myself. And it just really puts things into perspective when you realize that life is something that is very precious and our time is limited and we need to really make sure that we really embrace every moment that we are able to.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because, you know, as listening to you, you know, the work that we do resonates with you, you know, perfectly. We come at it from a different perspective in trying to get people to change the way they think about death in order to live their lives more fully. You're doing the same thing, except that we're approaching it through education and evidence that we're more than our physical bodies, where you're on the front lines dealing with somebody that's actively dying. So it's not quite the same thing, but the same goal.
We sprinkle a little bit of that evidence that there could be something more as well, because that is a part of the dying process, is that people do vision, you know, their deceased loved ones and even their pets. And so, and that's another component to my book is I had death anxiety as a younger person and didn't even realize that was a thing until I got on social media and had people saying in my comment section, "I'm so afraid of death and dying. I'm so afraid of death and dying." And I was like, "Oh, wow, this is something that's very common. People really have fear." For me, it was crippling. And when I became a hospice nurse, that was resolved. And I used to think it was strictly because, you know, I hadn't been raised with any religion. I didn't have any kind of concept of afterlife, and seeing people that were having these end of life visions made me realize, yes, there is something more. I don't know what it is, but this is happens so frequently. And you can't dispute that these people are really seeing what they say they see, because they're not necessarily on medications. They don't necessarily have any brain involvement with their disease process. So that was, you know, my thinking at first, that that's what helped to resolve this death anxiety. But then I came to realize that it's more than that. It's really being able to accept that we are all going to die, because once you get to this place of acceptance, you can just put it behind you. Like, you know what? I don't need to keep thinking about this. It is what it is. It's going to happen. I have no control over it. And therefore, I don't need to think about it. I can just spend my time thinking about how I want to live my life instead of worrying about the eventual, you know, death.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, over the years, I've talked to a lot of medical doctors that are administrators at hospice facilities, you know, like Chris Kerr in Buffalo, you know, and others. And but I don't know if it's changed over the past 20 years, but I used to encounter many people that worked and ran hospices, and they frowned upon a discussion of life after death, whereas some embrace it. Is it kind of the same? Has it changed at all?
Do you mean like talking to patients about that? Or
yeah, I mean, do they instruct their some hospice? Do they instruct their hospice nurses not to talk about the afterlife? Or
no. What we're not allowed to do is proselytize.
Right.
I mean, that we're not allowed to proselytize. If somebody brings up a conversation and says, "What do you think?" You know, I mean, we could say, "Well, what I think is this," you know, or it, the more appropriate thing to say is, "It sounds like you have some questions about spirituality, and you know, I wonder if you'd like to speak with our spiritual care advisor or our chaplain." Yeah. That would really be the more appropriate thing for a nurse to say, because that's what they're kind of alluding to, right? Like they're having an existential question. And so When we start seeing that somebody is concerned about, you know, something that's existential, that's the time to bring in the chaplain, because that's their wheelhouse. But there are times when we might have a conversation with a patient that we've had a relationship with, and they're sharing, you know, like, "What do you think? What have you seen?" "Well, I've seen people have deathbed visions. I don't know what happens, you know, but I have seen where people do this." But yeah, we can't really go to people and say, "You don't need to worry, because after you die, there's an afterlife." You know, like that's not what we can't do that.
Right.
Because that would be essentially, that would be proselytizing, right? Because really The reality is, no matter, people can be very, very convicted in their belief, whether it's you're a Christian and you believe you're going to go to heaven, or whether it's just someone like me who's agnostic who says, "I think there's something, I don't know what it is." But the reality is, we really don't know. And So we can't really take that to
but
the patient.
You might have been in a situation where, you know, loved ones are gathered around, you know, the person that's dying, and the loved one has a deathbed vision, and they reach out their hands and start talking to somebody that you know, their loved ones can't see. So the loved ones dismiss that as hallucinations, you know, A dying brain. And yet the dying person, I mean, there's no doubt that they're having this conversation. So, you know, I mean, maybe the loved ones of your patient might ask you a question about what's happening.
Oh, absolutely. They have. That's happened. I've had a patient at a care center call me in. The daughters called me in. I think I talk about that in my book. They called me in and said, "She's hallucinating," or was one daughter, "She's hallucinating. Can you get her something for that?" And so I stood there for a minute and watched her, and she was pointing up at the ceiling and calling out names. And all of a sudden she called out a name. Then the daughter said, "Wait a minute, that's my aunt she's talking about. She's dead." And I said, "Oh yeah." So this, yeah, we normalize that. Yeah, that's normal. It's okay. That's not a hallucination. We tell people It's not a hallucination. We don't need to medicate them for it. It's very common. It's in our literature. It's actually a sign that we look for if somebody is approaching the end of their life. Now, people can have deathbed visions weeks before their death. So calling it a deathbed vision is really almost a misnomer, because they're not necessarily on their deathbed when they see these people.
Right.
I myself have asked my patients, "Have you been seeing anything out of the ordinary?" I had one lady, I said, "Have you been seeing anything out of the ordinary?" Because I could see that she was failing, she was getting weaker, and I want to be able to let her family know, you know, like what kind of time frame we're looking at. And so I said to her, you know, have you been seeing anything out of the ordinary? She said, well, like what? And I said, well, like people that have died before you maybe. And she said, no, nothing like that. And I said, okay, because that's really normal. She goes, it is. And I said, yeah. And she goes, okay, well, my dad's standing in the kitchen. And she was 80. So I knew it wasn't her dad.
Right.
And she said, I didn't want to tell you because I was afraid you'd think I was crazy.
Yeah. The fear of being labeled or judged.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have an assessment tool that we actually developed for my hospice agency because there is a quality measure for visiting people in their last days of life. There's a Medicare quality measure. So we're trying to kind of course, death is unpredictable, but we're trying to kind of zero in on when we think people are getting close to the end of their life so that we can get the nurse or the social worker out to meet that quality measure. So we actually developed a tool to try to determine when somebody's in the last, you know, days to week of life. And that's one of the things on there that they're visioning, that they're having visions.
Yeah, I always found it interesting that much more so than the medical doctors, you know, hospice nurses were able to tell with great accuracy when somebody was nearing death, whereas the medical doctors really didn't have a clue.
Mm-hmm. That's so, in my book too. If you want to know when someone's going to die, ask a hospice nurse, not the doctor.
Right. I get it. You know, I'll tell you something I think you'd find humorous, but when my mother was about 2 weeks before she passed, and she was at home hospice, and the family, she was sitting in a reclining chair, and we as the family were sitting in a semicircle, you know, trying to talk to her, but she was in and out of consciousness. And then there was an empty chair directly in front of her recliner. And then suddenly her arms were outreached and she started calling and talking to her mother, you know, mama, mama, mama. And of course, the other family members thought what we were talking about before, oh, you know, this must be a hallucination. But my wife and I had been doing this work for a while, so we knew what was going on. And at that moment, my dad walked out from the other room and he saw the empty chair and he went and he sat down on it. And my mother, as sick as she was, started screaming, get up, get up. He didn't know that he sat on his mother-in-law. try explaining that to your, you know, 90-year-old dad, you know. But, So I've seen it many, many times with friends and family members. So I definitely believe possibly that we have escorts to the other side.
I love that, too. Yeah. And, you know, just listening to you say that makes me think, you know, when people say, how can you be a hospice nurse? It must be so hard. That kind of thing, like you just talked about, never gets old.
Right.
You know, like hearing that kind of story, I mean, it brings tears to my eyes because I just love that aspect of the dying process. I feel like there are things about the dying process that are really beautiful. And the reaching is another thing too, because, you know, people will do that reaching into the air. And I have finally just come to the conclusion that they are reaching for whatever it is they see, you know, because almost always it's like, sometimes it is in front of them in a chair. You know, I've had some people tell me that too, but like a lot of the time it's up above them, it's in the corner of the room that they're seeing these visions. And then they do that reaching up into the air. And I really do that think that's what they're doing. They're reaching for those people. And I think also that, yeah, they're being met. They're being met by someone.
Yeah, it has tremendous spiritual implications. And there are also cases, as you know, where people have written about, you know, shared death experiences where not only do the dying person see a deceased loved one, but so do some people that are in the room. It doesn't happen a lot, but it has happened. So that's interesting. You know, I don't know if this is something that you could really talk about, but I have a personal reason for asking because of my experience in hospice, but with pain medication, I know that hospice as a general rule cannot, for legal or other reasons, you know, accelerate somebody's death. My experience was that my wife was on a pain pump And she was, you know, I pressed the button every 15 minutes, but she was in such agony that it wasn't enough. And I remember I couldn't change the dosage, so I called the hospice facility, and I told them that, you know, they have to come and increase the dosage. And the nurse called me back and she said, my supervisor, you know, won't allow it. And I said, why? They said, well, she said it's too dangerous. And, you know, and I said, do you hear yourself what you're saying? You know, what's the worst that could happen? She's dying and she's in agony. So what's the worst that can happen? She'll die? I mean, you know, listen to yourself. And then she called me back later and then she said, okay, we're going to send somebody to increase the dose. So, I mean, is there any set protocol regarding that? I mean, you know.
No, that to me is malpractice for I don't know who her supervisor was, but she should have been calling a doctor, not her supervisor. I'm guessing the supervisor was some other, you know, maybe clinical person, but you don't call your supervisor, you call the doctor. So there's no ceiling dose on morphine. It means that people can have as much as they can have as long as they're tolerating it. And, you know, if to your point, somebody's dying. What's the worst that's going to happen if we increase that dose, right? And, you know, we do not ever intentionally end somebody's life. We just don't do that. We administer morphine safely and we go up on it incrementally as the person tolerates it and becomes, you know, if they're having more pain, we need to increase the dose. Morphine has a bad rap. You know, people really think that, that hospice nurses use morphine to end people's lives. And I always tell them, you know, we don't just blast people with a massive dose of morphine. We give them a small dose that's actually less potent than a Percocet to start with, you know. But I have never, ever had an experience, and I've taken care of thousands of people, and I've taken care of a lot of people who were on infusions because I spent the first 7 years of my career working in a hospice care center where we had acutely sick, dying patients, did a lot of infusions. Never had a doctor tell me that we could not increase the infusion more if the person needed it. If the person needs it, we go up on it. They're tolerating the dose. If they're having pain, they're tolerating the medication, it's time to increase the dose, or it's time to switch the medication. But to tell somebody whose person is dying, who's suffering, and that caregiver is communicating that to the hospice nurse, and the hospice nurse is like, well, you know, we can't really do anything about. They should be at your house. They should be assessing her. They should be calling the doctor. They should be looking at different options for other opioids to add, which we can also do, or adjunct medications like a benzodiazepine. But to tell somebody whose person is suffering at the end of their life that they can't do anything, that's not a very good hospice. I'm sorry.
No, yeah,
That's
I know.
not.
I think back to the days of Dr. Kevorkian, and when I first heard about him, I was aghast. I mean, how dare he, you know, take some? And now I think he's a hero. I think you reach a certain point with this zero quality of life, you know, and combine that with suffering. I just don't see the point. But I
Well,
know.
I live in a medical aid and dying state, so I'm lucky,
Oh, okay.
because it's legal here.
Yeah.
But yeah, I wish it was federally legal. And that's the thing too, you know, I think hospice, like hospice on a whole, generally speaking, will say that we should be able to make everybody not suffer at the end of their life. But when you work in hospice and you see that there is, people can have existential suffering, and that's worse than pain because it's harder to treat existential suffering. And sometimes we end up doing palliative sedation where we sedate a person until their death. And to me, what's the difference between that and just allowing them to take a medication that will end their life safely and humanely? You know, like what's the difference? So, but unfortunately, you know, it's hotly debated. And so
I know.
therefore it's not federally legal, but hopefully it will be someday.
I hope so. It seems like the humane thing to do. When, as a general rule, just out of curiosity, would you say that the majority of patients that are close to death, and communicative, express fear about what's next, or
you know, not, I would say no. People do when they're first given the news that they're dying now. Yeah, you know, like it's legit, you're dying. We expect that you won't live longer than 6 months. We're going to send you to hospice. We're referring you to hospice. That can be really terrifying. But once they get past that first part of shock, kind of like what we were talking about earlier, they get to a place of like acceptance. Like, okay, I have this amount of time left, and what do I want to do with that time? That's not to say no one's ever, ever afraid. I remember we had a patient one time who was, she was a younger woman. I think she was in her probably early, I think she was probably in her like mid to late 40s. And she was really having some existential suffering. And we were giving her, she was on a couple of different infusions for pain, and she just wasn't settling down. And the nurse I was working with, I was a new hospice nurse at the same time this was happening, was pretty new. And so this other hospice nurse who was, you know, really experienced said to her, "Are you in pain?" And she said, "No." And she said, "Are you scared?" And she said, "Yes." And so in that case, we ended up doing palliative sedation for her. So we had to do, you know, Versed on an infusion to make her asleep until her death. So that was one. And there was another guy who wasn't really expressing, like he was so close to the end of his life, he wasn't even able to say, "I'm scared." But I could tell that he was really agitated. It was a young man. He was in his early 40s. And he had a COPD, I think, or a lung cancer or something with his lungs. And he was really, really scared. And I had given him morphine and was standing at the bedside with him, holding his hand. I'd just given him the dose. And the aide was on the other side holding his hand. And we were just kind of with him. And all of a sudden, and he was just, like you could tell, he was just fearful. But he looked up at the ceiling and this look of peace just washed over his face and he died. And it was just incredible. And I looked at the aide and I said, "Have you ever seen anything like that?" She goes, "No, have you?" And I was like, "No, I haven't." I mean, it was just, words cannot do that situation justice. It was just something that I can't even describe what it looked like to me. Like this guy just all of a sudden, he just had peace.
Well, that was one of the sacred moments that you're talking about. Right?
Yeah. And so those are the two that I remember that were afraid. You know, most people, by the time they're dying, they get to a place of acceptance and they're not afraid anymore.
Yeah. We're talking with Nurse Penny Smith. She's you could follow her on social media at Hospice Nurse Penny. Check out her new book, Influencing Death, Reframing Dying for Better Living. Penny, I saw one of your videos where you talked about the two sides of dying. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, I heard this from a doctor one time. She said that there's two sides of dying. There's the physical side of dying, and there is the emotional or spiritual side of dying, and both have to meet for death to occur. And so that's when we have somebody who's extremely physically uncomfortable and they cannot let go and die, even though they're emotionally prepared. So you might have somebody that is just like totally fine with it, like, "I'm ready to go." You know, even people that are super religious are like, "I'm ready to go." But physically, they're just not there. Maybe they're in a lot of pain, or maybe their disease just isn't progressed enough for them to be ready to go. Like, I remember distinctly my husband's great aunt was actually a patient at the hospice care center that I worked at. She had end-stage heart disease, and she kept getting kind of where she'd be like close to the end, and then she'd get better again. And she was in her 90s. I think she was 92. And she was at our care center for 18 months. And she just kept kind of getting better. And then she'd, you know, like tank again and do badly. And I remember her saying towards the end of her life, she said, "Oh," and she was a very, very religious woman, "Oh Lord, why have you forsaken me? I am so ready to go," you know, and her body just wasn't there yet. And then you have people who are physically ready. They weigh 90 pounds. You know, they have this no meat on their bones whatsoever. They're completely, you know, full of tumor. They're just like, you just are wondering, how is this person still alive? But they're not mentally or spiritually ready yet to let go.
Yeah. Do you also find that some people, it seems as if they wait for their loved ones to arrive, you know, before they pass, or the opposite? They wait for their loved ones to leave because they don't want to see them die. It's sort of like they need permission.
Yeah, that's my favorite question that people ask me, because it's one of those questions where actually people will comment in my comment section, "I feel so bad. I wasn't there. I stepped out for 5 minutes and he died while I left the room. And I feel so guilty. I wasn't with them." I love that kind of comment, because I can always respond to that with, "Listen, I have seen enough people either wait for someone to arrive, or even more often wait for them to leave before they would die. And if they need you to be there when they're going to take their last breath, they will wait for you to get there." It does seem like people have some control over it. And like, it's just, you see it too many times to think this is a coincidence. The family is vigiling at the bedside. You're just wondering, like, what is keeping this person here? And they go, "You know what? We're going to go out and get some breakfast." And the moment that that door shuts behind them, the person dies. It just happens so frequently. Yeah. I really do think that people have some kind of control. And it does seem to be certain personality types. People who are kind of more introverted or private. Parents don't often, like mothers, don't often want their children to see them die. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah. Another thing that, I don't know if it's in your book, it probably is, and I've heard you talk about it. I mean, researchers have different terms: terminal lucidity, sudden awakening, but people that are really close to the end have, for no medical reason or no medical explanation, suddenly have this 24 hours of perfect clarity. I saw that with my mother-in-law when she was about a week or two from passing. I couldn't communicate with her at all. I'd sit there from morning till evening, and it's just basically watching her. And then I showed up the next day, and she says, "Oh, hey, Bob, listen, the holidays are coming up. What are we going to do? And you got to take my tax return over to H&R Block." And I'm like, holy shit. I went in the other room. I called my wife. Said, you better get your ass down here right away, because this is a miracle, you know. And then it lasted for 24 hours. And then she went back to the way she was, and she passed shortly thereafter. So do you have any theories about how that happens? Because medical science doesn't really have any theories.
Well, so I've actually seen a theory online that makes sense to me. We call that the end of life rally. Terminal lucidity is kind of a newer, more medicalized term. I only learned about that term a few years ago. We have always called it the end of life rally. And it is when a person does just suddenly look like they're all better now. They have a burst of energy. Sometimes they want to eat a meal. They want to have a conversation. Somebody told me their mom wanted to play bridge, bring all of her friends over to play bridge. Does usually last 24 hours or less, and they almost always die within about a week. We have to reframe this for people, because, you know, we need to manage their expectations, because they think the person's getting better. So we try to reframe it to, like, this is a window of opportunity for you to spend some time with your person. It may not last. And the funny thing about this end of life rally is that even when you've seen it many, many times, it's almost something that you recognize better retrospectively. Like when you're in the moment, it's so like profound. You do wonder, are they just getting better? Like, you don't even really know for sure until they go back into that state of dying. That's what it was. But the the theory that I saw, and we don't do testing on dying people, which is why we can't really, you know, figure out what this is. But somebody had said that, or somewhere along the line, I read that there's a thought that it is because the organs are shutting down, there may be hormones that are excreted that are causing this. And that makes sense to me because steroids are a hormone. And when we give people steroids, it perks them up. It makes them want to eat. It makes them be awake. You know, it makes them talk more. And so that really makes sense to me. When I read that, I was like, that makes perfect sense that is why that would happen. But that being said, I feel like there's just some mysteries around death and dying that are better left unexplained. And like, let's just let them be, you know, a beautiful phenomena and not try to prove everything. I like the theory. It's a great theory, but I'm just fine with that being a theory and never proving that. Just like I'm fine with, we don't know why people have visions at the end of their life, and it does bring them comfort, and it may be something that, you know, is created in our brain at the end of our life. It's not really real, but I just as soon think that it really is spirits coming to visit, you know, because it does make, you know, the idea of death a little bit more palatable.
Yeah, I believe that. I mean, you know, there's just hundreds of thousands of these reports that are similar. And of course, with this rally, the spiritual theory is that people are given one last hurrah to say what they need to say, you know, to their ones, you know. So, I mean, that's another from a spiritual perspective. This is important, I think, for people to know if they've ever sat with a loved one that was dying. And you've talked about this. People that are actively dying exhibit a death rattle. And to loved ones, that this sounds like the patient is in terrible distress and pain. And you know, I remember I had to walk out of the room. It just was unbelievable. But I would imagine that it's just a biological thing that's not necessarily painful. They're usually unconscious, right?
Yeah, that is something that we can actually explain. So when a person is starting to move towards the end of their life, they lose the ability to swallow. And we notice that because people will start coughing when they're trying to drink liquids, and then they can't get their pills down anymore, which is why we have to go to, you know, like an infusion pump, or just like the liquid oral morphine, you know, in the cheek, so that because they can't swallow anymore. So when they're dying, the secretions, like we normally all swallow our spit down all day long. We never even think twice about it. We're just automatically doing it. When they're dying, they're not swallowing that saliva down anymore. And they're usually laying down on their back. And so that builds up in the airway. And when they're breathing, the air moves over that liquid that's in there, that saliva that's in there, and it makes a gurgling noise. And rattle is kind of a misnomer because it can sound like a rattle, like, but a lot of times it sounds like a washing machine. But people do worry that their person is going to drown in those secretions. They're really worried, and they're not. I mean, I could tell you, I've seen thousands of deaths. Nobody's ever drowned. They've always died from their disease. You know, and we have medications that are supposed to dry those secretions up, but I have never liked them. Since I've been a hospice nurse in the past 20 years, it's been, you know, scopolamine patches first, and then it was a glycopyrrolate, then it was atropine drops, now it's hyoscamine. It's like all these different things that we try. Nothing ever really works well, and what it does is it dries the mouth out. So you're kind of trading off this gurgling noise for the comfort of the person, because they're then going to have a dry mouth, which can be uncomfortable even if a person is, you know, unresponsive. So I just like to do a lot of education, and I've always found repositioning is the best thing. I put the head of the bed up, I put the person over on their side, and those, you know, gurgling, rattling noises just can really decrease and oftentimes just go away completely when you do that.
Yeah.
But I just try to tell people, it's just a noise. It's just a noise.
Just a noise. Yeah, they're not really in horrible pain from it. It's just reaction. What also was quite I don't know what the term for it. I couldn't believe that somebody could not eat for 2-3 weeks and still be alive. And yet,
yeah,
you must see that all the time.
Yeah. So funny you say that. I actually just recorded a video today about this because somebody was on TikTok saying that her mom hadn't eaten or drank for 12 days and how is she still alive? You know, we say the rule of thumb is if a person's not eating and they're not taking any liquids, they usually don't live longer than 7 to 10 days. If they're not eating, but they're still getting some kind of liquids or fluids, then they can live about 3 weeks. But I've had a patient who didn't take any food or liquids for 3 weeks and he still lived, you know, like it took him 3 weeks to die and he had no food, no fluids at all, nothing. But he had been really hydrated at the hospital before he came to the care center. So it really depends on, you know, the reserve the person has. Were they hydrated? Do they have a good fat reserve on them? But typically, you know, if they don't eat or drink, usually not more than 10 days, but they can go, you know, like longer than that. I've seen.
Yeah, I know. That was my experience. I mean, it was 3 weeks and I would, at that point, as hard as it was for me to say, I mean, I was, you know, I wanted her. You know, I wanted her suffering to end, you know, and it lasted 3 weeks, you know, and I said, how is this possible? But like you say, it sometimes varies by person, but.
Was that your wife?
Yeah, that was my wife. Yeah.
And was she fairly young?
She was 66 when she passed.
Okay. That's young. So I'm 62, 66 is
right.
Young.
Yeah.
I mean, there's lots of different factors. And you also said that she was on an infusion, right?
Right.
So she was getting a little bit of, even though we, of course, I don't know about that hospice agency. In my agency, we use highly concentrated, because oftentimes we're doing subcutaneous infusions. But if she had a port, she may have had not as concentrated as a drug. And you know, if somebody's not moving anymore and they're just actively dying and they've got just a little bit of fluid going in, it could be enough just to kind of keep sustaining them. It depends on her reserve also, you know,
right.
What she was like when she got sick, how long was she sick for?
Right.
But I want to, and I know your show is about grief, and I wanted to touch on what you said about how it seemed wrong, but you were hoping, right, that she would die.
Right.
That's something else I like to talk about a lot in my social media is and talk about in my book as well, anticipatory grief, because I love the saying that anticipatory grief is like being forced to watch a whole movie when you know the ending is bad. And with a person dying, the movie is them dying and the ending is their death, and you're watching this happening, and there gets to be a place where we do like start to wonder, when will this end? When will this be over? And it causes people so much guilt, because then when the person dies, they feel like they were wishing their life away, you know, and I get this in my comments all the time too. And it's like, it's normal. That's so normal. And I think even just telling people that is normal. It is normal for you to feel that way. You're watching this and you know that the outcome is bad, and it's normal for you to want that to be over and to end, because you're so worried that that person is suffering, when really, if the person's comfortable, they're not suffering, right? I always say lingering does not equal suffering for the person who's dying, as long as their symptoms are managed. But for the people who love that person, who are watching this happen, it can be brutal. I mean, that is your suffering to watch that person lingering for so long. But sometimes, you know, death just takes a while.
Yeah, I mean, it is brutal. But you know, some people, like in her case, I mean, she was ready, you know, to go. And she was puzzled. At one point, she said to me, there's a line. And I said, what do you mean? There's a line of people waiting to get in? She said, no, there's a line and they won't let me cross the line. I'm dying and they won't let me cross the line. I took that to mean that, you know, that something was keeping her alive when she didn't want, you know, she didn't see any point, you know. So
did she have spiritual care from the chaplain at all?
No, but we've been doing this work, for since our daughter had passed away in 2002. So she was a very spiritual person, had a great inner knowledge and was intuitive, and so she was well versed in that. It took a while for her to believe that she was actually dying, but once she came to that realization, she wasn't fearful. She firmly believed that she was going, to another place, and she was ready, but so that was troubling. Do you recommend that people talk to somebody that's unconscious, a person maybe in a dying
Yes.
state? Yeah, you do.
Yeah,
Okay.
yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, because there's been some studies that show that people can hear up until the time of their death. And so we always encourage people to talk to them. They can hear your voice. And my social worker I used to work with would say, if they don't understand the words, they feel the intent. So I always thought that was pretty nice.
I
I like
do
that.
agree. I agree with that. I mean, you said something, I don't remember if it was video or I read it, but being alive isn't the same thing as living.
Oh, yeah, no, not for sure. I mean, that's absolutely for sure that you can be alive and not be living. I mean, it happens all the time. People who are on life support in the hospital, people who have dementia, who live in a nursing home, who are being fed and who are just existing. That's not living. That's just being alive.
Yeah, and
But
that's
I
what
wanted to ask you something. So you just said that your daughter died. Did your wife see her daughter when she was dying? Did she ever say that to you?
No, but she did see her deceased aunt that helped raise her, and she was
Oh.
again with the outreached hands. And talking to Leah, her aunt. It's funny you mentioned that because that's what I would have thought, but it's possible. I mean, then we get into a whole nother discussion, if there is another dimension that we go to and there's constant improvement and learning and moving to a higher frequency and and vibration. Quite a lot of time, had elapsed, and my daughter might have been busy doing other things,
Yeah, or like you say, go to another dimension, whatever, and get raised to a different level, and then that some there's belief that sometimes you become a spiritual guide, and there's the theory of reincarnation. Your daughter might have been doing something else,
And of
It's
course,
so
having the
interesting.
Having the, I think that those who believe that we're more than our physical bodies do better in their grief than those who don't. When my daughter died, I just went to sleep every night praying that I wouldn't wake up, because I had no foundation of belief. I thought death was final. Having my wife die, was equally devastating, but I didn't want to die. I knew that she was in another place and very possibly, reunited with my daughter. So I think that, it's sort of like cognitive, behavior therapy. If you could change the way you think about death, that could make it easier to live, and that's
Yeah.
what we
And
found.
it makes it easier for you to die too.
That's a good point. We don't have a lot of time left, but I mean, do you find that people in other parts of the world treat the dying differently than we do in this country? I mean, is there, less people going into hospice, more people at home, that sort of thing?
I don't really know how other countries' hospices operate, but I do know, like anecdotally from people that follow me from around the world and who message me, one thing that's pretty common is that there is like this general feeling that we shouldn't like that death is a taboo topic, like we shouldn't be talking about death and dying. And so that's more widespread than I thought. I thought it was just really in USA that we don't like to talk about death and dying, but it's actually in other countries too. People will hospice nurses from other countries will reach out to me and say, yeah, like it's really taboo around here too. And I've had hospice nurses from other countries tell me kind of what they do. And, you know, it's similar, like they use similar types of meds. In Canada, they call it palliative care when it's really hospice. They also have a different medical aid and dying law that's federally legal, and it's a euthanasia law. So it's in the U.S., in states where medical aid and dying is legal, the person has to self-administer the medication. In Canada, a medical provider, a doctor, will administer the medication to end the person's life. So, right. So that's a little different there. Like the UK, they're completely against medical aid in dying. They have hospice, for them is not limited to a life expectancy of 6 months or less. They can have a chronic illness that's known to be terminal and be on hospice, I've been told. So I would love to do like a world tour and go to all different hospice facilities all over and find out how they do things. But a lot of times it's very similar. I was DMing with in Instagram, who is a hospice nurse. I want to say Germany. And we were kind of talking about different things. And they told me, this is the medication that they use. It's very similar to morphine. It's an opioid. And, so we kind of compare notes and it's similar.
Well, yeah, unfortunately, we're run out of time. I could talk to you for hours about this, but
yeah.
I really appreciate this conversation. For our audience, follow Penny at Hospice Nurse Penny. She has a lot of different social media platforms. Her book is going to be a very important book. I'm going to add it to our recommended reading page. It's called Influencing Death, Reframing Dying for Better Living. As you heard, Penny, it's sort of a memoir, but also goes into many of the things that we talked about tonight. Penny, I really enjoyed the conversation. I really appreciate the work that you do. It's so important. You've helped so many people over the years, and that must be healing for you as well.
Definitely is.
Well, thanks. Yeah. And hope to talk to you again soon. I look forward to reading your book.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks, Penny. And thanks to everybody for tuning in. And we'll talk to you next week. Good night.